The second case on today's oral argument calendar is number A19-0339, State versus Allison Gardner. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Kohler, you may approach and begin.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Allison Gardner, in this matter. Everyone in this room knows that trials can be hectic, they can be chaotic. They are always less than perfect when it comes to objections, order of trial. In this case, we were dealing with the weather. But the goal for the rules of criminal procedure is to try to equalize the scales between the party and put together as fair of a trial as possible. We always equate trials to battles, where it's wits instead of weapons, but the rules of criminal procedure kind of wreck that analogy. We try to make sure that people aren't being ambushed in a criminal trial.
What's confusing to me, Mr. Kohler, when I read your brief, is you're not challenging the trial court's decision to admit the test results because of a lack of foundation, because there was no testimony from the person who drew the blood or urine or blood, I guess it was. So, I mean, so if there was no error in the court admitting it, then it sounds like we're talking about trial strategy, which goes to whether the court abused its discretion in any of these. Or it seems to me you'd have a stronger argument if you were saying, my challenge here is the judge screwed up and admitted these blood test results in the first place. But you're not saying that.
That's not an issue on appeal.
Right.
Correct. That issue was not raised. Counsel at trial decided he didn't want that to be the appeal issue. The issue here are the two rebuttal arguments.
So isn't it just more trial strategy that you're raising here in front of us then? And because it sounds like that was a strategic decision, maybe that defense counsel made at trial that the test results are probably going to come in, and so I'd rather challenge the reliability of them if the state isn't going to call the lab tech in their case in chief. It seems to me that's a way different argument in consideration for this court from a trial strategy standpoint, as opposed to whether the court abused its discretion in admitting the evidence in the first place.
Well, and the tricky part with that argument is that even if the court abused their discretion in admitting that evidence,
but
that person did testify, so there's not really a confrontation argument. It moots itself out when the judge then permits that person to testify, because the argument was confrontation, was that having that person testify was crucial to Ms. Gardner's right to confront her accusers, present a complete defense. And so bringing up that argument on appeal would have, maybe not entirely, but definitely looks moot, given that that person did come and later testify in rebuttal.
On page 17 and 18 of your brief, you repeated a number of times that what the district court did was an abuse of discretion. But I didn't see many reasons why what the district court did was an abuse of discretion. Tell me why it was an abuse of discretion.
Because rebuttal evidence is not something that's a new fact that just confirms the case's state in chief, case in chief.
So this, you don't think this was responsive at all to what your side did?
No, I don't think that this qualifies as rebuttal evidence in the slightest. The state's own expert said everything that defense experts said during the state's case in chief. It's more than just a stretch. I think this is the opposite of anything you could consider to be rebuttal evidence. This literally was new facts that were argued about since before the jury was sworn in, about whether this person was going to testify. There was a deliberate hole, and I'm not ascribing any bad faith to Mr. Berglund, but there was a deliberate hole in the state's case inviting the defense to attack it. And when we're structuring the order of trial, that's not possible. That's why there's rules against certain types of rebuttal evidence. That's why there's rules permitting certain types of rebuttal evidence. The cases cited by the state talk about situations where the defense was bringing up an affirmative defense, or the defendant himself or herself was testifying, where you don't know what they're going to say. Here, there was actually an omnibus transcript of Mr. Burr's testimony. The state knew exactly what Mr. Burr was going to say, but regardless of what he said regarding the blood draw, that same information came in from the state's own expert on cross-examination. And that was exactly what the district court judge told defense counsel to do.
Are you claiming that it was simply cumulative evidence?
It was new facts, but it was also, it wasn't anything that was rebutting something that came from the defense's case in chief. It was as in Walker, this was just new facts that belonged in the state's case in chief if they wanted to submit it.
What were the new facts?
The new facts were everything the person testified to regarding the blood draw, the use of the needle, and granted, the officer testified, which was information the parties got for the first time, that a BCA kit wasn't even used. During the state's case in chief, that was what the officer testified to. Then there was the fact that it was a low-volume blood draw, which also came out from the state's own expert. So the big thing was that the defense was invited to attack these unknowns. They couldn't confront this person in their testimony, so the strategy was, we don't know these things. We don't know what happened during that blood draw. We know it was low volume.
Did you object at that point to the admissibility of the state's evidence in the first place?
There were objections throughout. Multiple.
I'm talking about throughout. On this specific item, did you object to the witness testifying on the grounds that it was low volume or that it wasn't the kit?
Their trial counsel, which was not me, did make a motion for a judgment of acquittal at the end of the state's case in chief.
I'm talking about at the time the evidence came in. Was there an objection by the defense?
Regarding?
Some things we're talking about. So hard to distinguish it. You said the objection was low volume and the kit.
I maybe misspoke with respect to saying objection. Those were the arguments against the weight of that evidence to the jury, the facts that were being elicited.
The fact that it may be lacking in weight is not a basis, not much of an objection, is it, to admissibility? That's an argument you can make, but on the question of admissibility, was there an objection to admissibility?
Specifically on solely the issue of the low-volume test, I do not believe so.
How about the fact that it wasn't a standardized kit?
I would actually have to check the transcript and come back on rebuttal for that. I don't know if a specific objection was made at that point, other than there was the motion for a judgment of acquittal saying this test result can't even be used to convict because a kit was not used. And I know that that was an integral part of the motion for a judgment of acquittal, which in a roundabout way is basically the same thing as objecting, is saying you can't give this evidence any weight at all. They didn't even use the right materials to make their prima facie case. So in that respect, the objection was absolutely preserved. But the bigger question and the question for this appeal is, you know, is it appropriate rebuttal testimony to elicit new facts that should have been in the state's case in chief? And
well, if they should have been, it gets me back to my original question. Then why wasn't it, when they offered the blood test results, objection, lack of foundation?
That objection was there. I believe in the transcript, and I'm going off of memory, but counsel
said... That's not an issue on appeal. You're not challenging that here.
Correct.
It seems to me that would be the way to challenge this, if you thought the court had erred by admitting the blood test results, because obviously that's was a key part of this trial. You know, it just seems like we're ignoring the elephant in the room, and that's whether the results should have been admitted in the first place, and you're not challenging the court's decision to admit them.
The case law on that point is extremely disfavorable to defendants. In implied consent cases, there's a few more requirements for the introduction of a blood test. But in a criminal case, there's no straight-up bar if they use a non-BCA kit. There's a case I'm aware of, and I've tried a case, where they used a bottle from the back of their squad car to collect a urine sample. Somebody that's not qualified to draw blood, that's a problem in an implied consent case. This court has said that is not a problem at all in a criminal case. So the foundation for a blood test in a criminal case is extremely limited. The case law has basically put it upon defense counsel and the jury to determine how much weight is to be given this test result, no matter how many deficiencies there are in the actual collection, which again sparked the initial arguments over the confrontation right to bring this person to testify, the actual blood drawer. And again, which I don't see how that qualifies as rebuttal evidence.
Is it true that the state advised your client that intended to call this rebuttal witness?
It was on their disclosures before trial. And that was what sparked the arguments for the first 3 days of trial, where defense counsel repeatedly argued this person needs to be here for the state to meet their burden.
Well, the defense can obviously subpoena the person if they wanted him there.
But defense counsel is not in the habit of proving the state's case in chief because of the burden lies with them. And honestly, Ms. Gardner was already having difficulties hiring her own expert to come in and attack some of the other aspects of this blood draw, not just the problems that happened when it was drawn originally, but the use of retrograde extrapolation. There were also other problems in the offer of proof regarding the actual analysis. The defense counsel made the strategic decision not to go down that path, not to muddy the waters with the jury, which goes towards, again, then the rebuttal closing argument, where defendants attempts to rebut the state's expert with an expert of their own was met with further misconduct in calling Mr. Burr a mercenary. I know that the state's not conceding that that was improper argument. I think it clearly was. The connotations that come with mercenary are more severe than some of the other cases that were cited. Whether or not that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt or substantially led the jury to reach a verdict, the fact is that in this case, in the context of this case, the expert testimony was the crux of pretty much everything. It had to do with the alcohol concentration and how much weight could be placed upon that alcohol concentration. It wasn't ancillary to the state's case. It was of the utmost importance, and it touched on the evidence of every other witness.
You said Walker and Gore on the issue of whether this was an improper rebuttal. Did either of those cases involve what are you asking here for, a new trial?
We're asking for a new trial in this case.
Any of those cases involve the granting of a new trial?
Not on the grounds of misconduct. Those cases are cited for the proposition that it is misconduct. And then I'm arguing that based on the facts of this case and how much of it hinged on this forensic evidence, that you can't say it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
In looking at the defense closing argument, seems to me there's a lot of theories being raised there that beyond just the fact to which the rebuttal witness testified. For example, the suggestion that maybe she was impaired by lorazepam, not by alcohol. Also, that her eyes were red, bloodshot, and watery because she had been crying, not because of alcohol. That she failed the field sobriety test for other reasons other than alcohol. I mean, I thought your colleague did a good job of creating as many issues as possible. It seems to me that there was only at one part in the closing where we got to the issue of the subject of Mr. Burr's testimony about the taking of the sample and the rebuttal evidence. So I mean, on the issue of whether, if the mercenary comment was improper, can you tell me why that's not harmless?
Because of the importance that was put on the expert testimony in this case. Those theories, the ones dealing with field sobriety tests, were about the only arguments that didn't have to do with how much weight to put on this blood test result. But the blood test result is unequivocally the most important evidence in a DWI trial. Even if they're just dealing with impairment, we all know juries want to see that number. They put a lot of weight on that number, and the question is how much weight does it deserve? And when you've got a test outside of 2 hours drawn in an improper manner, the experts were both testifying regarding this is why we think you should or should not trust this number. And when you call one of them a mercenary, you're completely improperly undercutting the defense's argument with respect to that test. Thank you. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
Yes, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. You have 5 minutes set aside for that. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jesse Berglund for the City of Eden Prairie on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Today we're here on the issues of did the district court abuse its discretion in allowing the state to call a witness on rebuttal to rebut evidence regarding the blood draw, and additionally, did the state commit reversible misconduct during its closing argument? The scope of what constitutes proper rebuttal evidence rests almost wholly in the discretion of the court. It's an abuse of discretion standard. And the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure define this as that which explains, contradicts, or refutes the defendant's evidence. And what we have here is evidence that was narrowly tailored by bringing in Ms. Luck, the phlebotomist who drew the defendant's blood in this case, to testify as to the speculative factors that the defendant introduced through his expert. The defense expert, in fact, when you review the transcript, spent a good majority of his time testifying as to things that could have gone wrong on the blood draw, things that should be known during the blood draw, as opposed to the other issue that he was brought in to testify to, which was the retrograde extrapolation. He spent more time on that first issue than the second. And he testified about factors that would affect the validity and reliability of that blood draw, which were the qualifications and experience, conformity of the kit and equipment, and any difficulties during the collection process.
Were some of those issues the subject of cross-examination of the BCA expert by defense counsel at the trial also in terms of the importance of knowing the circumstances under which the blood draw occurred as it pertains to the reliability of the results?
They were brought up to the BCA expert by defense counsel, but I think defense counsel, if defense counsel in this case had just left it at that as the scope of the evidence, but did not bring it up on, in his case in chief as well, through his expert, I think the state would have been barred from bringing in Ms. Luck because that would have not been appropriate rebuttal. But because he opened the door, kept on going down this, I feel it created a evidentiary issue that the state, that it was appropriate for the state to rebut at that point.
So you agree that if, for instance, if the state would have rested after the BCA expert and the defense didn't present any expert testimony, perhaps just, or they didn't present any expert testimony, the state would have been prohibited or it would have been error for the court at that point to allow the court or allow you to present rebuttal evidence of the phlebotomist?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, because it was not an issue raised on the defense. I don't think there would have been anything to rebut at that point.
You've touched on the definition of rebuttal evidence in the case law, that which, quote, explains, contradicts, or refutes. Can you tell us more specifically which one of those three words you're relying on and how the rebuttal evidence did that in this case?
Sure. I think a little bit of everything. To explain is generally to make plain or clear, assign a meaning, interpret, contradict, to speak contrary to the assertions of, imply denial of, refute, to prove to be false or erroneous as an opinion or charge, to prove a person to be in error. Essentially, the defense argument is, if we don't know these things, the test isn't reliable or valid.
But no. Appellant's counsel has argued that your witness said the same thing. If we don't know these things, we don't know whether it's accurate or reliable. Is that true?
I think the witness did say things to that effect, but not fully. I think the witness rehabilitated herself on redirect and talked about that these are all just speculative things and that she had no reason to doubt the veracity of this sample in this particular case, that anything was wrong with it because it came in intact. It was a testable sample, and it did come up with a result that she was able to verify through her testing methods. I think because, again, the defense belabored this point, the state was ready to proceed and leave that as an issue of credibility for the jury. Because the defense decided to focus in on this in its case in chief, it did increase the amount of evidence, or I should say distinction in this case, that the state felt it needed to rebut it by bringing in the phlebotomist to allay those issues of speculation. There were several points that the defense expert did bring up that weren't even addressed by that weren't addressed by the BCA expert, but were addressed by the defense expert, such as what sort of alcohol swab was used and such. So there were some new issues out of that as well. I believe it was appropriate because this was narrowly tailored to meet the defendant's challenge. Additionally, as opposed to defendant's brief, there really is no case law out there supporting the hypothesis that rebuttal is only proper if unexpected or unanticipated evidence. Now, surprise may be a good reason for rebuttal, but it's not the only reason, and it's not certainly not required that there be surprise. In regards to the detrimental reliance argument, what we have here was, as per the court rulings in the state's case in chief, the phlebotomist was not required for foundation of admission of the blood sample. The defendant is not challenging that lack of foundation on appeal. The state informed the defendant on the record that the phlebotomist may be called depending on the testimony of the expert, which would be page 289 of the transcript, where the state does state, we want to hear what the defense expert says, and the phlebotomist may be called at that point. So this wasn't an issue of surprise. And additionally, she was on the original witness list provided by the state. So this was something that defense would have been able to expect as a potential witness in this case. In regards to the argument of prosecutorial misconduct, the state would argue that this was a characterization of the evidence, and it would be characterization of evidence of bias in the course of the trial. And what this means from the perspective of the state is this wasn't just implying that this witness was being procured by the defense attorney and being paid, which is implied bias for every expert and, in fact, any witness, because everyone, I think, who testifies in the court, you know, who works for either law enforcement, the BCA, is being paid somewhat. What this was in the context for the state was that it became clear on cross-examine of the defense expert that he testified differently depending on who his audience was, or I should say depending on who his party he was representing for. And that was the point the state was trying to get out in its characterization of the defense expert as essentially a mercenary. This was in the context.
Well, assuming we disagree with you, or at least one of us disagrees with you on that point, Mr. Berglund, mercenary is an incendiary term. Quite frankly, I think it was misconduct to use the term. I think it could have been argued differently. But my question then is, assuming we don't agree with you on that issue, what's your position on whether there was any prejudice as a result of it?
Your Honor, I would believe it was harmless error in this case. It was one statement in the scope of a rebuttal. There were six pages of rebuttal argument in the transcript. This was essentially one statement, which was a characterization of evidence, which went into the possible credibility and bias issues at that point. Additionally, this was in rebuttal. It wasn't in the state's primary closing, which there were additional pages of. The jury can make their own call on the weight of the evidence on this. That's what the judge instructed, you know, after sustaining the objective. And I would note this was a sustained objective, so I think that weighs heavily because it does give the instruction for the jury to disregard this. Finally, the evidence was strongly in favor of the state in this case. we're dealing with a case of retrograde extrapolation where there was a blood draw that was done 3 hours and 20 minutes after the driving conduct, where it still showed the defendant's blood alcohol concentration at 0.137, which is quite a bit over the legal limit of 0.08. And the BCA expert did testify that based on her retrograde extrapolation, she would have believed the defendant's blood alcohol concentration 1 hour after the driving conduct would have been 0.15 to 0.19. So based on those factors, the state believes it would have been harmless error in the broader scheme of things because of the nature of arguments that just the small point it was in the whole closing and the trial. Finally, the state would assert that the issues in regards to this and the experts only dealt with the blood draw, which was relevant to the 0.08 or above count, which none of this is relevant really to the other count, which the jury found the defendant guilty of, which was the driving under the influence charge. So even if the court finds that there was prosecutorial misconduct and it wasn't harmless error, the state would argue the other conviction on the other count should still stand because that can be based on independent evidence absent the blood sample in terms of that she was driving under the influence, and that would be that there was a vehicle crash here. The two officers arrived on the scene, both believing her under the influence of alcohol at the time, that they smelled the odor of alcohol on her, that she admitted to drinking alcohol earlier that evening before that morning, and that she was and that she performed poorly at field sobriety and such. So even in the finding of misconduct and possibly not harmless error, the state believes that that the other conviction on the other count would stand. Finally, I would just argue that the argument that the blood sample was drawn in an improper manner was an issue of credibility for the jury overall. And that's what the defense counsel asserted, but I think that's what the expert the phlebotomist when she came in was attempting to persuade, the state was attempting to use to persuade the jury that it was not drawn in an improper manner based on all the speculative items that the defense counsel had brought up through its own expert. So based on these reasons, the state would ask that the court not overrule the decision of the trial court and sustain the findings from the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berglund. Mr. Kohler, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honor, in response to your question, there was an objection made immediately at the close of the officer's testimony, pages 239 to 241 of the transcript, arguing that the state's test lacked foundation. The judge overruled that objection, found that it came in, and that the lack of a BCA kit went to the weight, which I discussed in my prior argument.
The objection wasn't contemporaneously with the introduction of the evidence, but was made later and a ruling was made then.
At the conclusion of the officer's testimony, correct. I believe the evidence had already been admitted at that point and this evidence came in after
that. Motion
was
what? To strike the evidence?
Now I'll have to look at the transcript again. I believe the argument was made outside the presence of the jury. Correct. Yeah, and so the argument was to suppress the results of the test based on lack of foundation.
What page is that while you have your thumb on it?
239 through the judge's ruling at 241 and into 242.
But that was related solely to whether the right kit was used, not because of the lack of foundation from the phlebotomist. Am I right about that?
Correct. That argument was continuing, and even when the blood result was introduced, counsel made clear, he said, no further objection. And then again, once the jury was gone, reminded the court, I didn't object when it got introduced because I previously objected. I'm renewing that objection now, and there was another argument there. And as I said, the case law in criminal cases is very lax towards admissibility and repeatedly says, you know, defense counsel, if they have problems with these tests, they have to attack the weight and credibility. That's what Ms. Gardner wants, and that's what this appeal really is about, is just a fair trial. When admissibility stops being the issue and it goes to weight and credibility, she deserves the right to have the state's witnesses testify in their case in chief so that she can properly defend herself in the defense's case in chief and not have her expert called a mercenary in the presence of the jury when almost everything to do with this trial had to do with these test results, the weight and the credibility of these test results. And that's not too much to ask for, because trials are hectic, and they are chaotic.
The counsel's argument that even if there's a problem with the test, we have a conviction on another count.
Yeah, and in a case like this, there's case law. I can't cite to it now, but there's plenty of case law talking about the importance of an actual value when it comes to a DWI trial. It's impossible to say that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that the jury didn't consider a 0.137 or the state's expert testifying it was as high as a 0.19 when it comes to impairment. It was, I believe Mr. Berglund misstated the evidence when said that the test result had no bearing on impairment. It clearly does. And defense counsel argued as best he could for the other factors. In this case, the officers actually let Ms. Gardner drive after she was originally stopped. So there was plenty of evidence she wasn't impaired. There was also this test result and how to interpret that. I can't see that as not being involved in the verdict to find that she was impaired. And if there is a new trial and she's found guilty of impairment, well, there we go. But that's the request.
I agreed with you. Wouldn't the procedure be it would go back to the district court? The district court would have the option at that point of saying, well, I'm going to enter the conviction for the straight misdemeanor driving under the influence count, and then you'd have to appeal that separately. Isn't that the way you'd have to address that?
We're asking for a new trial on all counts, that this be remanded for a new trial because either or and both, the rebuttal testimony was improper, denied the right to a fair trial, it was an abuse of discretion, and the improper argument in and of itself, or coupled with the improper rebuttal testimony, rendered her right to a fair trial absent. And so give us that new trial where the state puts on their case, she'll put on her defense, the arguments will stay above the board, and then the jury's actually in a position to decide the weight of this evidence that was significantly flawed from a foundational standpoint, and she will be able to exercise her confrontation rights, assuming the state brings Ms. Locke. And that's what we're asking for in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kohler. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. For the third case on today's oral argument calendar, the court has one substitution, and so the panel will briefly reconstitute itself. We are very slightly ahead of schedule, so assuming that the new three-judge panel is ready to go, we will proceed directly to the third case. Counsel in that case may come.